recording this on the evening of Wednesday, April 17th. Yesterday, April 16th, was the release of the 2024 federal budget. And I wasn't planning on doing a podcast episode on this, but I had a number of requests on social media and otherwise to release an episode that was geared towards people who don't practice in tax. And what I realize is there is a lot of amazing podcasts, blogs, newsletters that have come out in the last 24 hours that I have been devouring as a tax practitioner that are talking about the technical changes and kind of some of the planning we might want to look into. But those are not necessarily resources that are good for, you know, the average business owner or for advisors who aren't practicing in tax. So the purpose of this episode is really going to be to give some information that is applicable to business owners and taxpayers in Canada, and to try to explain how some of the buzzwords and the things that you might be hearing in the media, how it impacts you on a go forward basis. I guess I'll just put a proviso at the beginning, and I'll also do one at the end. This is intended to be a big picture overview. There were a ton of changes that came out yesterday, and I cannot get to all of them in this podcast episode. In fact, I was going to make this a mini episode, and then when I started putting together my notes of what I wanted to talk about, I thought, oh boy, I think this is going to take more than 15 minutes. So I think we've stretched it out already. So I am just going to hit the highlights. And this is also not legal advice. So all of this is very general in nature. If you're having questions about how any of this applies to your specific circumstances, you need to go and talk to your tax advisor. Maybe if you're going to talk to your accountant, maybe wait till after April 30th because they're stressed enough right now. And then we added the budget to the mix. So, you know, show them some love, give them a little break. Wait till early May to have the conversation. So what I want to do on this podcast today is I want to cover the following. First, I want to talk about, you know, what is the federal budget in terms of how it relates to tax and why do we care? So what is it as a tax practitioner that I'm doing in and around budget time, and give you a little bit of history on the federal budget. I then want to highlight a discussion on capital gains. So what are they? How are they taxed currently? How are they going to be taxed based on the new budget? And then as part of that, talk about the lifetime capital gains exemption, what changes were proposed in the budget, what it means, how it's used. And then I want to go through what I'm calling tax litigation changes. There's always a section in the budget that talks about things that are going to impact taxpayers in terms of how they file their returns, but also in terms of the relationship with CRA on audit, appeals, collections. And there's a few hot button topics that have popped up there that are causing me grave concern. And, you know, I want to pass this along to the masses, and maybe you guys will be just as concerned as I am. So that's what I'm proposing to cover today. I'm not going to get into carbon tax. I'm not getting into the home buyer stuff. I'm not getting into the new rental rules. I'm not getting into GST. None of that, none of the clean energy rules. I'm just going to stick to these big picture topics because these are the things I was getting the most questions on over email and DM and messaging in the last 24 hours. All right, here we go. Let's start with the federal budget. So I released a blog post back in 2021 on the federal budget, and it's available on the Learning Center if you want to go back and see it. And I described in that blog post that I think that the federal budget is kind of like the Oscars for tax professionals. And there's a few lucky tax professionals. I think they're lucky anyway. They get to go on lockdown on the day of the budget. So they essentially get locked down in a building somewhere in Ottawa. They get their phones taken away and they get an embargoed copy of the budget before anyone else does. And so I love going on LinkedIn the morning of the budget because everyone's doing their last post before they get their phones taken away. It's cool because you get to know what's going to happen before everybody else does. And if anybody knows how I can get on that list to get a ticket to get into that lockdown room, I would like to be locked in a room with a bunch of other tax professionals reviewing the budget before everyone else. I just think there would be this sense of camaraderie and it would be so incredibly fun. So if anyone knows anybody, let me know. I would like one of those golden tickets. Before I became a tax lawyer, though, I didn't really pay attention to the federal budget. I mean, I listened to it as a taxpayer in Canada, but didn't really think about the tax changes. I was mostly paying attention to the non-tax stuff, changes to healthcare, changes to rental and housing and those kinds of things. Now that I am a tax lawyer, I look at the budget very differently. And I have said on many of my previous podcasts that one of the things that has made me fall in love with being a tax lawyer is that you can't think about tax law as involving numbers and spreadsheets. You have to think about tax law as tax policy, public policy, because governments will make tax changes depending on what types of behavior that they want to encourage or discourage. And the best time to find out where the government's headed is the budget, because they're going to make some proposed changes and they're going to do it under the auspices of trying to promote this, that, or the other and trying to discourage certain things. And so I think it's the most fascinating time of the year because you get a real good idea of where the government is headed. So I block the day off of my calendar usually, try not to have meetings if I can avoid it. I sign up for webinars. I usually watch the live budget reading and the comments from the opposition in the House because I think that's entertaining. This year, the comments from the opposition were particularly entertaining. They were a bit dramatic this year, so that was kind of funny. Then I, of course, scour the budget documents along with my colleagues and then start figuring out how this applies to our clients. And so this takes up quite a bit of time around the budget. And I can tell you that any tax professional that you're working with is going through the exact same thing. And accountants are doing that on top of trying to get all your tax filings in. There's, of course, also usually a bit of a flurry of activity prior to the budget. So they'll always announce when the budget's coming down and kind of like mark it as D-Day in your calendar. And then inevitably, I start having people ask me things. They think I'm psychic. So about, you know, a month before the budget comes out, on every phone call I'm on with a non-tax professional, somebody will be like, what do you think is going to happen? Are they going to increase the capital gains inclusion rate? You know, are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? And I mean, I'm not psychic. I don't know. Usually I'm pretty good at predicting. I think that the tax community as a whole was kind of exhausted going into this budget with the pullback of the bare trust filings, with the complete debacle of the underused housing tax filings in October, and all of the draft legislation that has not been passed yet. So we really don't know what we're doing. We're in a complete state of limbo that I really didn't see the same level of excitement or concern heading into this budget. And I think because everyone was pretty worn out. And also we know an election's coming. So we figured, they're not going to do anything too crazy. Well, they did. So we were wrong. Some fun facts, though, about the federal budget. So I don't know if you knew this, but budgetary reports have been presented by the federal minister since 1867 in this country. And there's not actually a requirement for the government to present a new budget in each fiscal year. So if we think back to 2020 into COVID, the government chose not to release a budget that year because of the pandemic. And there's this interim authority in the legislation that lets the government spend money, and they just have to present estimates and get approval from the House. Now, there was a really long stretch, and it was before COVID, this was actually the longest stretch without a budget, but then COVID surpassed it. But the previous longest stretch was 482 days, and it was between March the 2nd of 1943 and June 27th of 1944. And that was due to a combination of World War II, also just a completely overwhelmed finance department. And they were overwhelmed because finance had higher revenues than they had projected, and the war looked like it was going to end. The public was really ticked off because taxes had increased. They didn't know how to explain to the public the fact that they were literally drowning in cash while the war was going on. And so a lot of the taxes that were considered to be unpopular ended up getting canceled in that budget when they returned. There was a really fun article in Maclean's a couple of years ago that talked about the history of the budget, and I will put that in the show notes in case anyone else is kind of a geek about this stuff like I am and would like to read it. So that's some info on the budget. Now, the government we know is in a bit of a deficit. Well, not a bit of a deficit. They're in a huge deficit. There's an economic crisis. I shouldn't downplay it. And so we knew they were going to try to raise revenues. They're still trying to do some cleanup from the pandemic years. They're trying to make things look good heading into an election year. And we just didn't know where they were going to get the additional money from. Nobody really knew where it was going to come from. We now know largely what they're trying to attack, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. The problem when you have a budget like the one that came out yesterday is that a budget is just a budget. It is not legislation. And so attached to the budget, and I'll put the links as well in the show notes, you'll see that there's like there's like the public PR document that, you know, has pretty pictures and has their little slogans over what they're trying to promote. Then there's these PDFs that actually give details, paragraph by paragraph, of the various changes. And one of those PDFs is what they call the supplementary tax schedule. And that's what sets out all the tax changes. And at the end of that document is something called a notice of ways and means motion. Basically, draft legislation. That's what it is. It's draft proposed changes to the Income Tax Act, to the Excise Tax Act, and any other related acts that are impacted by their proposed changes. There's two key things to keep in mind. One, it's draft, so it still needs to get run through the system and approved and passed by royal assent, typically. There's no indication of when that's going to happen. Secondly, for a lot of the stuff that they proposed, in particular, the key stuff on capital gains, there is no draft legislation. We have nothing. And so there's some stuff that's apparently going to happen as of June 25th, but we have no legislation to know how it's going to operate. And this is the world that we have been living in for the last couple of years, where these sweeping, crazy changes are getting made, but there's no legislation. And so we are stuck in limbo. It's very hard to know how to advise our clients. I feel like I spend a lot of time telling my clients, well, I don't know. It could go this way. It could go that way. It makes us look like we don't know what we're doing. We do know what we're doing. We just don't have the legislation. I think pretty much like 90% of the budget 2023 legislation on tax has not been passed. There's still a whole bunch of outstanding stuff from budget 2022. And some of those issues tie into what's happening this year. So we just have a great big mess. And I think it's important to think about this year's budget in that context, because a lot of what I'm saying and what others are saying about the budget is somewhat us predicting what things are going to look like, because we don't have the legislation to be able to go in and go, oh, that's what's going on. So that's important to keep in mind. Okay. First issue I want to tackle, capital gains. So I'm sure you've seen on the newspaper, on the radio, read about it online, on social media. There's been a lot of excitement about the change to the capital gains inclusion rate. And this was something that I had tons of questions about. You know, people going, what does this mean? What impact is this going to have on me? You know, should I care about this? The answer is, it depends. Such a good lawyer answer. I thought it might be helpful to talk about, you know, what a capital gain is, how they're currently taxed, and then explain what the proposed change is, because that might help you to understand how this might fit into your life. So keep in mind that when you're considering what you have to include as and be taxed on, it typically falls into two categories. And this is very broad strokes, but typically something is either income or it's capital. Income, 100% of it is taxed. I don't mean it's taxed at 100%, but I mean that if you have $100 of income, all $100 gets put on your tax return and gets considered for tax. Alternatively, as of right now in this moment, if you had a capital property that you sold or disposed of, and capital properties are things that can go up or down in value. So think of like shares, investments, rental properties, cabin properties, those sorts of things. You traditionally only had to include an income 50% of the gain. That is what is changing. So an example, let's do an example of an investment portfolio. So you have some investments. And initially when you purchased the investments, they were worth $100,000. And then you go and you sell the investments in 2023. And now those investments have grown in value and now they're worth $200,000. So the difference between the $200,000 and the original $100,000 is $100,000. That's your gain. Under the current rules, prior to budget 2024, half of that gain would be taxable. So you'd include $50,000 in your income and it would be subject to tax. And that was the case regardless of whether the property was owned as an individual or owned in a corporation. It was 50% inclusion rate regardless. The 2024 budget, though, makes some sweeping changes to that. So there's two big changes. The changes apply to dispositions after on or after June 25, 2024. So the government is giving this like 2 months to, I don't know, go hog wild. I'll talk about that in a second and dispose of a whole bunch of stuff. But if you have a disposition on or after that date, and you're a corporation or a trust and you dispose of or you sell this capital property, you now have to include 2/3 of the gain in income. So if you had a $100,000 gain, you previously would only have had to include $50,000 in income. Now you have to include 66.66% of that in income, or $66,000. But individuals are being treated differently. So if you're an individual and you have a capital property and you dispose of it after June 25, 2024, you get this initial threshold. There's different words that people are using for it, but essentially on the first $250,000 of a gain, you're still only going to have to include half an income. For anything over that amount, you have to include 2/3 in income. Now, if you take the same example we had before of the investments, person originally paid 100, they're now selling for 200,000, the gain is 100,000. If that's an individual that owns that, even if they're disposing of it after June 25, 2024, the gain is under that threshold amount of 250,000, so they're still only going to include 50% in income. But if a corporation or a trust owned that investment portfolio and they sold it, they would be subject to include 2/3 of that gain in income after June 25, 2024. Hopefully that makes some sense in terms of the difference. Now, as far as we can tell, these changes have no impact on the principal residence exemption. So if you're an individual, you own a house, you sell your house that you're living in all the time, we know that as a matter of principle and as a matter of tax law, you're entitled to an exemption on paying tax on any gain that you may get on the sale of that property. You have to fill out some forms and file it with your tax return, but you're not taxed on that. As far as we can tell, no changes to that program. But again, we have no draft legislation, so I don't know. There's some interesting food for thought on this change to the inclusion rate. So I mentioned earlier that the government's looking to bring in some revenues. And when you look at their projections, which are part of the budget documents, of what they're projecting to bring in as revenues, they have a huge projected number, although some say maybe not high enough. And it's all tied to this capital gains inclusion change, because they've given us like 2 months to go about and dispose of things and try to trigger a whole bunch of gains before the change to the inclusion rate comes in. And they're presuming that they're going to make some tax off of that. The question is whether or not you want to trigger something in the next 2 months. And that's going to be dependent on conversations with your advisors and your tax professionals, because there are still a bunch of other things that we have to keep in mind. We can't look at just these inclusion rules in a vacuum, because they operate within a larger set of rules that have come in the last couple of years that we need to be worried about. So one of those rules is there is an expansion of what we call the general anti-avoidance rule. It's sometimes referred to as GAR. And what that rule says is, even if you completed a bunch of transactions, you did a bunch of things, and each of those things was fully permissible under the Income Tax Act, the kind of the combination of doing all those things together was a little sneaky and was intending to sort of circumvent or sidestep what the Income Tax Act was actually trying to do. And that the government takes a step back and they go, yeah, we know you could technically do all those things, but it's fishy. We don't like it. So we're going to apply GAR to it. And there's a penalty that's involved with that, which has been increased. Well, they've expanded the scope of what GAR can apply to. And those expanded rules did come into effect as of January the 1st of 2024. So they're in effect right now. And they expanded to include some transactions that we previously would have considered to be fairly conservative transactions. And so it's really important that if you're doing something to try to trigger gains right now, that you're not inadvertently tripping up on these GAR rules, because you might save something on the inclusion, but then you might get hit on GAR, which is going to create further problems for you. There was also a comment that was made by one of the webinars I was on about what happens if the property loses value at a later date. Like, is it really the right time to pull the trigger and do the disposition? There's also something called alternative minimum tax that you have to consider when you're dealing with capital gains. And there was a whole bunch of changes that were proposed in budget 2023. They pulled back some of those in 2024. We still don't have the legislation in place, but alternative minimum tax is like it's like a catch-up tax. Because the government wants you to pay a minimum amount of tax on certain transactions. And so in the background, when you're doing these transactions and you're filing your taxes, there's always this behind the scenes calculation that's going on. And there'll be a number that comes out of that calculation. And if the tax you're otherwise paying is less than that number, the rule is you must revert to that number, the alternative minimum tax. There can be some impacts now with the changes that have been proposed to alternative minimum tax to the types of things we used to do to trigger capital gains. And so it is going to be important to do those calculations just to make sure that you're not otherwise triggering a problem for yourself. And I mean, alternative minimum tax is not horrible. You can claim it back over a 7-year period, but if you don't otherwise have income in the ongoing years to offset, you're not going to get the full benefit. So it's just something to have the conversation about. I was also listening today to the Moody's private client webinar, which was fantastic. It was like a great fireside chat amongst tax practitioners. And they raised a very interesting policy comment on the capital gains inclusion rate that hadn't really occurred to me till they started talking about it. And they talked about the concept of tax integration. So in this podcast, I have talked before about what it means to have tax integration. And the idea is that in Canada, we say if you earn a dollar of income personally, you should pay the same tax on that dollar as you would pay if the dollar was earned in your corporation and then paid out to you. And it's not perfect. In each province, there's slight differences, but there's not supposed to be this huge advantage to creating a different type of structure like a trust or a corporation if you're just going to be blowing all your income out. The only advantage of those types of structures should be tax deferral. If you're going to be holding stuff in that entity for a period of time, you're not getting that second layer of tax right away because you're holding on to it. And so Canada has always tried to be perfectly integrated. This whole change to the capital gains inclusion rate completely blows tax integration out of the water. Because if you think about it, now, if you're a corporation and you have a capital gain, 2/3 of that gain is included in income. But if you're an individual and you have the exact same property and you have the exact same gain, you get that $250,000 threshold where you only have to include 50%. Then only on the amount above that do you have to include 2/3. So what's starting to kind of float around in some of the tax practitioners' heads is this going to change the way we advise our clients to hold property? So things like rental properties. I mean, it used to be that you'd suggest you'd throw them into a corporation, helps with creditor protection and all sorts of other things. Well, if you're going to be buying and selling these properties, is it a good idea to have it in a company? Maybe you should be owning it personally because of these changes to the inclusion rate. So I think it's going to trigger some different conversations because it's almost creating a slight advantage on this one particular issue to holding things personally, which is never something traditionally that the government has done. There are also two other circumstances that we're going to have to be thinking about this inclusion rate that have an impact for taxpayers generally. One of them is death. So I've got a couple podcast episodes on taxation on death. And if you're a client of mine, you've heard this spiel from me before, that immediately prior to your death, you're deemed to sell everything you own and reacquire it at fair market value. And I call it the biggest yard sale of your life. And why do we do that? Well, because in Canada, there are many things that you own that the government will never get its pound of flesh from because you're never going to sell it to a third party. You're just going to keep passing it down to the next generation and the next generation. So they have to some way figure out how they can force you to do a fake sale of the property. Then they can receive tax on that fake sale, and then you can move on. And this is because in Canada, we don't have estate tax. We don't have inheritance tax. We don't have gift tax. We don't have any of the things that they have in the US, right? And so this is the way for the government to trigger these things. Now, there's lots of exceptions on death to this particular rule, but that's the general rule. So now, as an individual, when you die, we hope that they'll still give you the $250,000 threshold for capital gains, where you only have to include 50% in income. But then any amount over that in gains that you trigger from this yard sale, you're going to have to include 2/3 into income. This could have a pretty major effect on many estates. And so when you're doing your estate planning, this is going to be a new thing you're going to have to start figuring out. If you'd previously done the math and thought, if I died tomorrow, what would my tax bill be? Your tax bill is likely going to be different based on the 2024 budget now. And where are you going to have the funds to pay for that tax, et cetera? So that's a huge one. Because we don't have draft legislation, we don't know what the exceptions are going to be to this inclusion rate. And a lot of practitioners have said, hey, can we please accept out what we call deemed dispositions, like this fake yard sale and death? I highly doubt that CRA will accept those out, but we don't know what the rules are going to be. The other one that is getting people really excited is if you are departing Canada. So if you're residing in Canada, you decide, I don't want to be a resident of Canada anymore. I want to go and be a resident of another country. When you leave the country, you file a final tax return and you are deemed to dispose of all of your property in Canada and reacquire it. And it's the same thing as death, right? It's this attempt, this last attempt for the government to get its pound of flesh from you, because then you're leaving the country and they're not going to get taxes from you anymore. So if you're leaving the country after June 25, 2024, you're going to have the $250,000 threshold where you only have to include 50% in income. But any amount of the gain that's over $250,000, you're going to have to pay tax on 2/3 of that gain. Whereas if you left Canada before, it's 50% across the board. So I've heard a number of people planning to accelerate leaving the country earlier than perhaps they had planned to because of that. So that's the capital gains inclusion rate, which talks about when you sell a capital property, how do you pay tax on the gain? What amount of the gain is included in your income? But keep in mind that for years, there has been an ability to shelter the payment of tax on the gain as a whole. So even if you have to include 50% in income, you may not have to pay tax on it if you fit into certain categories. And typically those categories are farm and fishing property and certain small business shares. I do not have time today's podcast to talk about the criteria, but just keep in mind that for farm and fishing property, just because you're a farmer or you're a fisherman and you have a corporation that you operate your farm or your fishing enterprise out of, does not mean it's farm or fishing property for the purposes of these rules. Similarly, if you own a private company, you have, you know, ABC operating company, it does not mean that those shares meet the necessary tests to be sheltered. There are very specific rules that are involved that you have to fall into. If you fall into those rules, each individual has an annual exemption amount. And that's been indexed for inflation for many years. And so the government said, great news, we're increasing the exemption amount, the lifetime exemption amount. It's being increased to $1.25 million. You're welcome. And everyone got very excited initially because they thought, wow, this is so great. It used to be closer to a million. Now we have 1.25 million. But when you think it through, as of June 25, 2024, individuals now have to include 2/3 of a gain in their income on a gain over $250,000. So if there's a $500,000 gain, the first $250,000, you take half of that and put it in income. The second $250,000, you take 2/3 of that and put it into income. So you're having to put more in income than you would have before June 25, 2024. Therefore, there's more gain that you have to shelter. So I think what the government's doing is they're just trying to make sure that the exemption keeps up or matches the rate of the inclusion. They had to increase the exemption because they were increasing the inclusion. The last set of items I want to talk about are what I'm calling the tax litigation changes. And there have been increasing compliance requirements, increasing penalties. We know there's been lots of changes to appeals, audits, collections. There were a couple of doozies this year that really made me panic, and I want to raise those with you in this podcast. So the first one relates to Section 160 of the Act. And I posted about this on Instagram, and I had some people say, what is Section 160? Like, should I know about this? And yes, you definitely do want to know about this. So Section 160 is a provision in the Income Tax Act that deals with non-arm's length transfers of property. what the heck is non-arm's length? Well, you know, think about transfers to your spouse, to your kids, to a very close business partner, to a very close friend, to a company that you own, those kinds of things. And essentially, if I owe Canada Revenue Agency $30,000 and I say, I'm not paying you CRA, I'm going to take this asset that I have, either an investment or maybe a bank account or something that's worth $30,000, and I'm not going to pay you CRA. I'm going to give it away to somebody else to hold on to, and then you can't find me. And so I take that money and I give it to my spouse. Well, Section 160 of the Act allows CRA to go after my spouse for the $30,000. So they can actually look through me, go straight to my spouse, and me and my spouse would then be jointly and severally liable for the 30 grand. So as soon as I paid off the 30 grand, my spouse is off the hook. Similarly, if my spouse paid off the 30 grand, I'm off the hook. That's the concept behind Section 160. This can extend to corporations. And this is what I'm seeing a bit of a trend in some of my client files, where a director and an officer of a corporation, and this includes if you're like on your school's preschool board or a church board, you have these same liabilities. Directors and officers are legally responsible for GST remittances and payroll remittances. You can be personally liable for those. And there's not really a due diligence defense anymore. It's very limited. Similarly, if you're a shareholder of a company and you receive a dividend from a company, and at that time the company owes CRA, income tax, GST, payroll, the CRA can come through the corporation out to you and say, hey, you got a dividend. I want that money back. You got to pay the corporation's tax debt. Now, there are certain factors that need to be at play for that to come into effect, but I'm seeing this reach through to shareholders more often than I used to. What CRA is trying to do in the budget, or what they're proposing to do in the budget, is to expand this rule. And they want to also catch taxpayers that are participating in what they call a series of transactions intended for tax debt avoidance. They're also proposing to include penalties in that circumstance. So right now, Section 160 is typically just this requirement to pay the tax and then interest. But there's now going to be this penalty component that's going to be layered on top of it. This is likely intended to tie in with some of these new general anti-avoidance rules that I talked about earlier. But if you're doing some tax planning where you and some non-arm's length people are transferring some property around and there's a tax debt owing, these new provisions could very well come into play. And it's quite expansive. The other measure that's concerning me relates to this notice of non-compliance. So there's two pieces of this. CRA has created this new concept, or I shouldn't say CRA. Finance has created this new concept called a notice of non-compliance. And they talk about its impact in two ways. The first deals with limitation periods for an audit. So right now, if CRA comes and audits you, they're only allowed to go back a certain period of time under the legislation or the statute. And if they want to go past that period of time, it's considered to be statute barred, and they have to jump through some hoops to get there. And so what happens is sometimes the audit gets a bit delayed and you get really close to that statute barred period and CRA has not made their final decision yet. You're still exchanging documents. So CRA will usually come to you and they'll say, hey, it's going to be statute barred soon. You have two options. One, you can either waive the limitation period and let us just take our time. Or two, we're just going to reassess based on what we know right now and you can fight it out in appeals. Well, now they're going to have a third option. So they are proposing in the budget to allow CRA to stop the clock in certain circumstances and allow that statute barred period to hang in the air without requiring a waiver. This is terrifying in my mind. I think it's quite scary. It's going to put a lot of taxpayers in limbo. And as part of this, they've introduced this concept of a notice of non-compliance. And they're saying, you know, we're getting a little ticked off because we're sending out requirements for documents. We're sending out requests for information to taxpayers. They're not responding in a timely fashion and we're having trouble getting stuff. We want to be able to have a hammer that we can put down. And so they want to create this concept of a notice that says you have not been compliant. You have not responded to whatever request that we have. And for every day that this notice is outstanding, we're going to hit you with a penalty up to a maximum of $20,000. Now, what is not clear here is, you know, what happens, you know, in terms of that penalty and how it can be pulled back if they're asking for something that is outside the scope of the legislation, covered by solicitor-client privilege, etc. But they're indicating that this notice of noncompliance can actually apply during the time that you applied to the court to fight it. So not great. Definitely expanded powers to get information from taxpayers. And then finally, they've also expanded the ability to dictate how information is obtained from taxpayers. So they're expanding it to say that CRA can demand that information or documentation be provided under oath. So that means like an affidavit, or, you know, you're sitting there with a court reporter and giving oral testimony, which is not traditionally something that would have happened in the audit or appeal stage. Usually that's just happening at the tax court stage or the federal court stage. There appears to be now this proposed ability to ask for something to be given under oath at audit stage. I mean, this is increased costs for the taxpayer. It's definitely an increased complexity for the taxpayer. It's a bit of a scary direction that they're moving. And it'll be curious to see how quickly they start to use those powers once they come in. So I have now been talking for over 30 minutes, so much for a mini episode. That is all that I have time for today. If there are specific aspects of the budget, the tax provisions in the budget that you would like me to cover on a future episode, please send me a message, thetaxchickpodcast@gmail.com, or hit me up on Instagram at tax.chick, and I will be happy to create a little mini episode on the topic for you. If you are looking for some more blog posts or other general information on tax, estate planning, tax litigation, business stuff, I do have my website, www.thetaxchick.ca. And if you click on Learning Center, I have over 70 blog posts that are available for free once you create a free member account that you can access, as well as some other resources. I did release 5 episodes to start off season 5 last month, including a whole bunch of episodes on trusts. So if you're listening to this and you're talking with an advisor about incorporating a trust or creating a trust as part of your plan, and you're thinking, I don't know what a trust is or how it's taxed, I have some mini episodes that give you the skinny on trusts and how they're used in Canada. Thank you if you stuck with me this long on this podcast episode. I hope that this was helpful. I hope that you get as excited about the budget every year now as I do. As I said at the beginning of this, please note that this is not legal advice. I encourage you to consult with your legal advisor, with your tax advisor for advice that's specific to you. The purpose of this episode was simply to provide you with general information. That's all for now. Stay tuned for another guest episode that's going to be coming up in May. We're going to be talking about donor-advised funds. So exciting. Have a great rest of the week.